This story of Esther that we've been going through has been a bit of a roller coaster ride, hasn't it, to coin a phrase. There's been lots of ups and downs that we've been taken through with Esther and Mordecai. From the time when Esther became queen and Mordecai became an official in the court, to when Haman wanted to destroy Mordecai and the Jews and sent out that edict saying that the Jews should be annihilated on that day, to Esther and Mordecai, if you like, getting one over on Haman, and ultimately Haman paying the price of his treachery. Last time we saw, didn't we, if you remember, the difference between the plans that people make and the plans that God uses for his own purposes. Very often, you know, people like to make their own plans, and we think, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and maybe God has other plans. Well, that's what happened to Haman, wasn't it? He made all those plans that he felt were great for him, and it was all working out nicely, so he thought. But it all turned on one simple event, the fact that the king couldn't sleep one night. And that changed everything, just a simple thing like that. And that's how God can work. God can change plans of men, or he can frustrate the plans of men. But God's plans and purposes are never frustrated. They're always worked out. And we saw, didn't we, how men's plans mean nothing when God is in charge. We have the benefit of hindsight, don't we, as we look back over this story. We know, we can read what happened, we can see what was going on, and we can look at these events. But what we discovered was more important was that God has foresight. God doesn't need to look backwards to see what's going to happen or what happened. God knows what's going to happen because he's purposing those things. It's his foresight and his planning that causes these things to happen. The people here who were involved in this story, I guess, they would only be able to marvel. Esther and Mordecai would just marvel at the way God had changed seemingly impossible situations to benefit his people. And the same thing happens today. God can change any situation for the benefit of his people, to bring about his plans and his purposes. God's not limited by the plans of men. We should gain encouragement from that. We should gain encouragement from the fact that our God is in control. Even in a world that seems very often chaotic and out of control, God is still in charge. God is still in control. And we might not be seeing the bigger picture sometimes. We might be limited in our view of things, but we can trust God is working behind the scenes, just as he was through his book of Esther. God's not mentioned in the book, is he, at all? But we know that God was working these things out behind the scenes. So we may not see the big picture, but if we're labouring for God, if we're working for God, then that labour is never in vain. So here we are at chapter 8, and we've come to the end of quite a tumultuous day, haven't we, for Esther and Mordecai and Haman, of course, as well. The day started with Haman thinking he's going to hang his enemy on the gallows he's built. Haman's thinking, you know, how well his life is going, how good things are, really. But now, it's his enemy Mordecai who has triumphed. It's Haman who's been hanged on that gallows. And both Esther and Mordecai are being rewarded for their faithfulness. So this is a story now of rewards and reversals in many ways. First of all, some rewards. You know, it was the practice of the day that the estate of a traitor became the property of the king. And so Haman's property became, quite legally, the king's. And we know how wealthy Haman was, don't we? He was a very, very wealthy man. And everything that Haman owned became the king's property. And the king gives it all to Esther. He gives everything that belonged to Haman to Esther. Esther is rewarded with the estate, the property, the belongings, everything of Haman. And Esther reveals her relationship to Mordecai. She explains to the king what their relationship is. She tells him about the whole situation. And she actually gives the running, if you like, of the estate to Mordecai. She makes him in charge over it all. So in fact, Mordecai effectively becomes in charge over all of that wealth as well. And the king also honours Mordecai, doesn't he? And he does this by giving him his signet ring. And what he's doing there, he's basically saying, Mordecai now is second in command. You remember that the signet ring was the symbol of the king's power and authority. It had been given to Haman earlier to wield the power of the king. And now it's Mordecai's. The king has effectively given to Mordecai the wealth and the status of his enemy Haman. It is now Mordecai who is second only in the kingdom to the king. And the irony is, this Jew, whom Haman sought to destroy, now wields the power that Haman once had. Mordecai, whose situation had seemed desperate just a few hours earlier, has now been rewarded beyond his wildest dreams. And you know, God always rewards the faithfulness of his people. God always rewards the faithfulness of his people. Remember the parable of the talents, where the people that used the talents wisely and were faithful to their master, how they were rewarded when their master returned. And the one who just buried the talents and didn't use it properly and wasn't faithful in that respect had even that talent removed from him. Well, you might be wondering what your rewards and blessings might be if you're being faithful to God. What rewards and blessings are you seeing? You might be asking yourself. We ought to remember that many of the things we take for granted are blessings from God. What we do tend to notice is when we're less than faithful and those blessings disappear. Because blessings can disappear if we're not faithful to God. Hosea chapter 8 verse 7, talking about Israel, says they sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. And what he's saying there is that you sow what you reap. If you're not careful, if we're not being faithful to God, we will end up losing the blessings that God has for us. If we want to be faithful, if we want God to bless us, we must remain faithful to him. But of course, God rewards us beyond blessings of everyday life, if you like, as well, doesn't he? We find that we have special blessings sometimes in our lives, that God does special things for us, that we are rewarded in other ways, maybe. And sometimes those blessings, those encouragements, come often in the darkest times of our lives. I can certainly bear testament to that, because Karen and I both knew incredible blessings from God while she was going through her illness, when she was suffering. We had great encouragement from God, even though it was such a difficult and a dark time for us. But we knew the blessings of God in a special way. We also have other rewards to look forward to, don't we? This life that we have here so often is a bit of a miserable existence. But we have a blessing to look forward to, rewards to look forward to beyond this life. And the Bible tells us that we go through this life, and if we're faithful to God, we're building up rewards in heaven. Have a look in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 with me, verses 10 to 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 to 15. That's what Paul writes there. He says, "By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives,
he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. See, what we build in this world determines rewards in heaven. We all have the same foundation. That's where we start. We have the foundation, Jesus Christ. That is the only foundation. And it's upon that foundation we must build as we serve God in our earthly existence. And once that foundation is laid, it can never be removed or destroyed. We will be saved. That is a given if we trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. But what we build with on top of that foundation determines our reward. If you build with things like precious metals and precious stones, the good deeds of life, if you like, they will be tested by fire and they will remain and they will be our rewards in heaven. Don't ask me how it works, because I don't know. God doesn't tell us what the rewards are exactly, but he promises us that these will become our rewards. But if you build with the things of self, the straw and the hay and the wood, those things will be consumed by the fire. And yes, you'll get into heaven, but that's all you're going to get in with, the skin of your teeth. There will be no rewards. You will suffer loss, it says. Because the rewards, the blessings that you could have had, will not be yours. But I need to issue a note of caution as well here. Because if you're just seeking rewards for reward's sake, you're not going to get those either. Those who seek rewards will not find them. That's not what God wants. Esther and Mordecai didn't do what they did in the hope of personal gain. They didn't do what they did in the hope of personal reward. They did it for the love of their people. And they were both prepared to lay their lives on the line for the sake of the people they loved. I read this quote recently from a lady called Virginia Law Shell, and this is what she says. She says, "I heard a story about a young man who needed to buy a car. His father asked him how he intended to find the money to buy it. And the son explained, 'Recently I gave a gift of £50 to God. And when God sends my 100-fold reward, I will have 5,000 and I can buy my car.' And when the father realized that his son was serious, he said, 'God is already sending you your reward. It comes every month and it's called a salary.'" And she says, "It's time we Christians stop and assess what we really believe about prosperity. Because a life lived for the glory of God is its own reward. A life lived for the glory of God is its own reward." If we're seeking to serve God in the hope of gaining rewards, then we're seeking to serve God with the wrong motive. We're not serving God because we love him. We're serving God because we want something from him. And rewards will not be forthcoming in such an event. This should be our attitude, shouldn't it? A life lived for the glory of God should be reward enough, actually. That should be what we desire. That should be good enough as a reward for any of us. It's nice to know that God rewards the faithfulness of his people. But our faithfulness must not depend on our desire for rewards. Next, we have some requests. Esther could simply have been happy that she and Mordecai had been rewarded. They could both settle down to a nice comfortable life at court, having everything they could possibly want, living in comfort and luxury. However, for Esther, her comfort and well-being was not her main priority. Her comfort and well-being was not her main priority. Even though she personally benefited in a wonderful way from this situation, she's not content with that. That's not what she really wanted. And once again, she comes before the king and she pleads on behalf of her people. Once again, she makes it personal when she comes to the king. After all, the king had no loyalty to the Jews as a people, did he? Her hope, again, lies in how the king feels about her. She falls before the king, weeping and begging him to stop Haman's plan against her people. And the king, of course, permits her to speak once again by extending the golden scepter. And she's clearly more confident that she comes into his presence at this time. And she appeals to the king, doesn't she, based on his love for her. She doesn't simply ask that the king save the Jews. Rather, she asks that he saves the Jews for her sake. She makes it very clear that she couldn't bear to live with the knowledge of her people, her family, as she puts it, having been destroyed. You can be quite sure that if the king had no love for Esther, this request would have fallen on deaf ears. He had no reason to grant this request other than the fact that Esther had appealed to him personally. I wonder where our concerns lie. Are we content with what we have so that we've got no other thought for perhaps members of our family who might be suffering? Do we have the same concern that Esther had for the wider Christian family? Are we just happy when things are going okay for us? Even though Esther was unable to change the situation personally, she couldn't stop what was going to happen personally. She did what she could, didn't she? She did everything that she could. She made an effort to influence the person that could make a difference. And in doing that, she did make a difference. We so often think that it's up to somebody else to get the job done. It's somebody else's responsibility, not mine. And that can be true whether we're talking about things in the local church or things in the worldwide church. There's always somebody else better placed, more gifted than us. So we let them get on with it. Oh, we'll help out when it doesn't cost us too much. When it's a relatively easy thing for us to do. We'll give what we have plenty of to help. But when it comes to making a sacrifice or stepping out of our comfort zone, we'd rather somebody else did it. Both Esther and Mordecai were driven to do what they did by the love they had for God and God's people. Jesus said, didn't he, that people will know we're his disciples by the love we have for one another. How far would you go for a member of your immediate family? How far would you go for a member of your immediate family? If they had a need, would you do everything in your power to meet that need? Perhaps even to the point of self-sacrifice, giving up something of your own to help them out? I think most of us probably would. Because we're driven by love for that person. Because we care about that person. We want the best for that person. Well, that's the love we should have for our Christian family. And it shouldn't stem from guilt. It should stem from a genuine desire, a genuine love that comes from being members of one family. You know, it hurt me to watch Karen suffer. And I'd have gladly given anything to stop it happening. Why? Because I loved her. And I loved her more than I loved myself. You know, it hurts God to watch his children fall into sin. And God did give everything to save his children. And it hurt God again to watch his son suffer. But he accepted that suffering for the sake of those he loved. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. He gave his son because he loved the world. That's how much God loves his family? How much do we love the family of God? Now, I'm not suggesting we can meet all the needs of all the Christians that we hear about throughout the whole world. What I am saying is we can do something. We can do something. But we have to be prepared to sacrifice some of our comforts in order to do so. It might be as simple as giving up a bit of time, maybe to lend a listening ear, or to go to a prayer meeting. It may mean going out of your way to offer a word of encouragement to somebody who's feeling a bit down. It might be writing to your MP to make a stand for a Christian in need. It may even mean going to Africa to support and encourage Christians there. I don't know what it is that God would have you do. But I do know if you're willing to look past your own comfortable existence, there is something of value that you can do. And it might be something simple in the fellowship here, it might be something that God's got for you elsewhere, who knows. But we all need the heart of Esther, who wept for her people because she loved them. Next comes retribution. Under the Persian law, it was not possible to change the original decree that had been sent out. But the king permits Esther and Mordecai to send out a new edict of their choosing. He says, do what you think is best to resolve this issue. He left it up to them. In the same way that Haman was able to send out the first one, stamped with the king's signet ring, so Mordecai had the same authority of the king to issue this new edict. And you'll notice there's an urgency about all of this. There's an urgency about the way it is sent out. And twice that's mentioned. Verse 10 tells us that the couriers who took it out rode fast horses, bred specially for the king. Verse 14 tells us that they raced out, prompted by the king's command. Do we have an urgency in what we do for God? The lives of Mordecai's people were at stake here. And Mordecai wanted to get this notice out as fast as possible throughout the whole kingdom. His urgency was based, again, on his love for the people. The message he was sending out was one of salvation for the Jews. Do we have an urgency about the message of salvation that we have? Do we care about the people who are going to a lost eternity? Does it matter to us that every day souls are being lost? Do we have an urgency about us in spreading the gospel message? When I read this story, I never understand some of this, to be honest. I never understand this edict. Why did the Jews need permission to defend themselves? Surely, if you'd had warning that you were going to be attacked, and you knew which day it was going to happen on, and you're going to be put to death, you'd put up some resistance, wouldn't you? I've wondered the same thing very often about the Jews being herded into the gas chambers in World War II. Why didn't they fight back? Why didn't they do something? Maybe some did, I don't know. And I guess if you're not in the situation, it's hard to understand. It's quite possible, of course, that most people in the kingdom were allowed to assemble into large groups for that very reason. They didn't want trouble stirred up by people getting together and assembling in large groups. So if anybody tried to do that, they were immediately stopped. So it may have been very difficult for the Jews to do that. I don't know why they had to do it this way. What I do know is this decree changed everything. It permitted the Jews admittedly on one day only, to assemble and then destroy, kill, and annihilate anyone who attacked them. It uses the same wording that Haman's very first decree used about destroying and killing and annihilating the Jewish people. They are now permitted to kill, destroy, and annihilate anyone who attacks them. Notice they weren't to provoke the attack. They were permitted to defend themselves. They weren't allowed to go out and attack people themselves, but they were permitted to defend themselves against these people. You know, God always provides a way for his people. And although in some ways this seems a little bit strange to me, I'm sure it wasn't strange to them. God's working his plans and purposes out, and this is how he did it. And God provides a way for his people even when the odds are stacked against us. This doesn't mean we're going to win every battle. What we do have is the assurance that God already has the victory. As we'll see later on, this edict didn't stop the bloodshed, but it certainly saved the Jewish people. If we have a genuine desire to serve God, even though sometimes the way ahead looks impossible, even though we can't see which way to turn, God will provide the means for his people. We're not going to triumph in everything. There will be losses on the way. But we already know that God has won the war. And that's something that we can hold on to, even when it's difficult. Finally, in this chapter, we come to the reversals. We're reminded how things have changed in the matter of hours. There's been a complete reversal, in actual fact. As Mordecai leaves the palace, he leaves having had a complete reversal of fortune. Now he's dressed in royal robes. Now he has everything that once belonged to Haman. His life has literally changed overnight. He's gone from being a condemned man to the king's right-hand man. Not only that, the Jews in the citadel of Susa have gone from a situation of complete despair to one of hope. This reversal has been so dramatic that both Mordecai and the Jewish people celebrated throughout the whole city of Susa. And again, we have a reminder here, don't we, of what God achieves in each of our lives if we turn to him. We go from being condemned to being co-heirs with God's Son in God's kingdom. We go from death to life. It's a complete reversal of fortune. God dresses us in royal robes. He gives us an inheritance that nothing can ever take away, that will never fade or be destroyed. He dresses us as Mordecai was dressed, in royal robes, the clothes of the king, because we're co-heirs with the Son. That is a dramatic change, to go from death to life. And that's what happens when we turn to God in repentance. That's how dramatic the change is in our lives. So what have we learned from Esther today? In summary, we might say that following God always brings results. Following God always brings results. May not be the way we expect. It may not be what we want sometimes. But God never, ever leaves us and forsakes us and lets us go and fail. God is always there with us. He always brings us through, even through the difficult times. God rewards those who are faithful, not just through the blessings we have in this world, but the blessings yet to come, rewards in heaven. But we must remember that those who seek to serve God simply to be rewarded will end up disappointed. We should pray that we might have a heart for the people of God, like Esther and Mordecai did. not to be content in our own comforts, but our desire should be to meet the needs of God's people wherever we can. We should have an urgent desire for the lost. Again, that springs from the love that comes from God. Again, going out of our way to bring the good news of salvation to the people around us. And we should remember that we serve a God who is able to change all things for his glory. A God who changes people from death to life.